This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this morning I'm joined by Rachel Romeliotis, Strategic Content Director and Chair of OzCon and Fluent Conferences at O'Reilly. Thank you for taking time out of your morning, Rachel.
Yeah, happy to be here.
To start off, can you tell me a little bit about who you are?
Sure. So I work at O'Reilly, as you mentioned, and I run an editorial team that covers programming content far and wide, honestly, from anywhere from C# to Java to Lua to JavaScript. Some of the things we're really highlighting lately are sort of like digital transformation in the form of, say, microservices or continuous delivery. We also have conferences around these areas as well, which I'm involved with. So busy times, people are always learning.
And the two conferences that I mentioned at the start were OzCon and Fluent. Can you tell me about those?
Sure. So OzCon has been around for almost 20 years now. It's an open source conference. It started as a Perl conference and grew well beyond that. And it's been a place where people have come to talk about, what open source means to them, what it means to the world, what new projects are out there. It has evolved to today being a place where developers come to learn about different projects and different ways of doing things, showing off their pieces. And an important piece is how enterprise really is, which has always been involved in open source, how enterprise can move open source forward now that it's essentially one everywhere and is being used everywhere. So that's OzCon. Fluent, on the other hand, is, I think, 5 years old this year. And that one's more, it started out as a JavaScript conference. And that one, at this point, we're talking about this year, how to build a better web. So it's everything from core JavaScript things to what can you use outside of JavaScript, front end, back end, performance, accessibility, sort of like here we have this like wonderful, world changing thing, the web. You know, how do we continue to evolve that and to make it better and better?
Are those conferences coming up in the next few months?
Yes. Thank you. So OzCon is May, I believe, 8th in Austin, Texas. And Fluent is June 20th in San Jose.
Just I'm not familiar with when exactly South by Southwest is. Is it around the time of OzCon?
No. So South by Southwest, I believe, is the actually pretty close. I think it's March, like the mid of March. So it's a couple months after that. So you can totally go to that, recuperate, and then head back out to OzCon.
Is your own background in development or in the more the content, the writing and the organizational work?
Yeah, no, it's definitely more in the content side. When I first got into publishing, I saw an acquisitions editor position, which was basically like, figuring out what content an audience needs and developing out that content. And it happened to start with books. And I don't know. I was just like, I think I can do that. And I actually like, in some cases, coming to a new area and trying to figure out what are the important pieces and how can we work with people to help them do a better job. So for me, it started with books, but it's obviously gone on to conferences and we do videos and we do online training. So, definitely content, but along the way, you pick up a little bit of development here and there. So, but pretty surface though.
And one of the roles you have at O'Reilly as well is writing, and that's where I came across your work. You wrote an article relatively recently about what you consider the five trends for 2017. That's going to be what we discuss mostly for the rest of this podcast. We're going to kind of just go through them one by one. So the first thing that you wrote about, was what you think is going to be the impact of open source this year. So could you tell me about that?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, so open source, basically people go around saying it won, because we use open source languages all over the place. We have frameworks. There's a very healthy open source community. So basically it's won. But so what does that mean? It doesn't mean we can rest on our laurels. And how does that impact business? That's sort of what we're seeing now. You have something like Red Hat, which is a huge and successful open source business. And that's like the first example. I think they had made it to like $1 billion or $2 billion business built on open source. So one of the things about open source that I've been kind of looking into is, you know, how is this a driver for digital transformation? And the thing that actually caught my eye was how all of a sudden Google, I think it was, open sourced TensorFlow, and then OpenAI was open source. And so that kind of made me think, you know, it's really, that's interesting. Do you know what I mean? Like, here you have something that's proprietary and you've decided to drive the industry forward, you're going to open source something. So not only can you benefit, but everyone can benefit, and an industry is brought to life. And so I'm looking at how that affects sort of different industries. And, you know, we know that developers enjoy open source. It's a way to bring developers into your company. It's a way to use the brain power, I think, of a larger community. It's a way to think about, there's something called inner source. That's a way to sort of set up a team or a culture in your company in the way that an open source community is put together. So there, again, there's this sort of like communal, let's work towards the betterment of this project. So I think those are ways that we're seeing open source really affect sort of new industry. And with industry that's sort of been around for a long time, when you open source something, it just makes everything, I think, all that much easier. It saves money, it saves time. So I think that there is a big effect, I guess, with open source in enterprise.
Do you see any move by the more traditional companies to open source? Not necessarily the tools that they're using or the tools that they're creating, but their own code. So let's just take a simple example, a small financial company. Sometimes the thing that their advantage is their software. They're right. Never going to open source their software. But I've been at conferences where there have been talks by people from the likes of the Free Software Foundation who advocate that they should anyway. Mm-hmm. Do you see any move towards that? Because I don't personally.
So, I mean, you see different companies. I mean, that's a really good point where, you know, they will open source a portion, at least, or a watered down version. And I don't know. I think I know what you're saying. So that's where the money is. And that's, you know, that's proprietary. But I think there's some open sourcing, I guess, that can be done that I think would behoove not only that company themselves, to see where that, you know, if you put that out in the wild, what that would evolve into, and would help the industry. I think it's more of sort of like the rising tide, lifts all boats type of attitude. I think with financial companies, I mean, I think, you know, look at something like blockchain, like how is that going to affect, financial companies? And that's something that's obviously open source. So I think it spurs innovation. And I think people should do it. I think you're right. They don't necessarily always do that. And I think it's a hard thing to, and that's kind of what I'm looking into. I don't have all the answers, obviously. But it's hard to change that mindset, I think, from being a proprietary business to being an open source business, sort of from like the inside out. Like that's a big change. So, you know, what does that mean to how you're driving revenue? So I don't, that's something I'm looking into this spring and summer. I really want to kind of find out why.
I think an interesting example would be the likes of Microsoft, Google and Amazon. They've mm-hmm. all, at least Google and Microsoft, I'm not sure about Amazon, I presume they do. They all have a significant amount of open source free software. But I don't think Alexa, Cortana or Google, is it called Google Go? I have a feeling they're probably not going to be releasing the source code of those, because those are the highly competitive tools that they have at the moment. And the advantages of one is what maybe brings customers to Alexa or to Cortana.
I think so. I mean, I think that's true. I think it's also about ecosystem. I think it's about lock-in. And those are companies that have open sourced other pieces of, you know, machine learning code or whatnot. I think it's more about lock into that environment. I think, I don't know. I mean, the stuff is pretty amazing behind all of those, everything that you mentioned, you know what I mean? But I don't think that it's necessarily, I don't know if they're like, it's that difficult. It's just little pieces of code here and there. I think that, that differentiate them. So, yeah, I mean, I can see it as a competitive advantage, but I think that's, I just think that's a small piece. I think that's a small piece of competitive advantage. It's more about, you know, they talk about how, I think, was it the iPod, how it was presented. It wasn't like, here is some storage for things that you have. It was like, carry your music. You know what I mean? So I think these things that we're seeing, these digital assistants, are more like, when the thing that catches your eye with Alexa, for instance, is like, you have a question and it can answer it for you. You know what I mean? You don't think about it necessarily as being better or worse, I think, than Siri. Although maybe we do in this. I don't think the greater world, you know, outside of maybe software development, thinks about like, well, I think that Alexa is more accurate than Siri and stuff like that, you know?
No, that's fair enough. I'll move on to the next thing that you wrote about in that article. And it was that you think that all businesses are software businesses.
Yeah. So, so basically what I mean there is, I think that every component of what a company does has some software component. And there, as you well know, is a lot of change, in software all the time. And I feel like there's actually a little bit more recently. And so in that way, we're driving forward what's possible. And actually having, I think, like a full seat at the table, by having these capabilities, and helping them sort of like, the other departments ideate on what they should do.
Do you think though that companies are, let's say the C level, the executive levels, they're as aware as they should be of the value of software? Because in the past, let's say some older, more traditional companies have viewed the software development team as those kids in the corner doing something who don't necessarily deserve the respect that they should.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would say yes and no. So, you know, they've made it to the C-suite, right? So they're smart people, generally. I don't think they realize the capability that that team and that software has to transform a business or to make it more powerful. Like, I don't, and that's one of the things we're looking at, actually. Like, so you and I can, you know, talk about machine learning or AI, and instantly we're like, yeah, powerful. And I wonder sometimes if the C-suite realizes the investment that would go into that and how that would change possibly, you know, how they're delivering, say, how they're interfacing with their clients. The data that they could compile and give back to their clients. So I feel like on a surface level, and this is a broad generalization, they realize it, but I don't think they realize the transformative power. I mean, it makes a software team sound awesome, which they are. The transformative power that is within that team.
Is it, so from a software developer's perspective, I have seen developers doing the opposite of what the C-level people are doing and viewing themselves as the only important people without realizing that you could have the best code in the world, but it doesn't really matter if you don't have a sales and marketing and operations and fulfillment and support. Do you think sometimes development teams lose sight of their piece in the whole thing?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. That's sort of the other side of the coin. So I think, so what's really important is that the software team realizes that they are part of a bigger team in a company, and that, you know, while there's certainly time, I think, to be, isolated and working on a problem or an issue, it always rolls back to sort of enterprise goals and what, the larger company is doing, because you're sort of the engine that is making that happen, I think. And if you lose sight of sort of why you're doing things, first of all, I think you might get complacent, but I think that you become, you know, as a contributor to a company, much more powerful if you realize why you're doing what you're doing, and then you can actually start to change the direction of a company or make suggestions about, you know, basically coming from software, being able to say, you know what we can actually do here? Let's try this. Or if I'm understanding correctly, you know, what you want to accomplish, what you're asking us to do is really not the right way to do it. So I think it's more about communication. I know this seems all sort of like, yay, everybody get along. But I think that's really important, both for both sides to really understand and appreciate what they do for a company. Because to your point, I think, yeah, you do need all of those, you know, departments. And I think, though, if they're all isolated, that's not going to work either. Everyone has to be working together.
Just one note for myself on that. I am on kind of the importance of software to companies. I just interviewed a gentleman in Sydney on quantum computing. And as we were wrapping up, I asked him, what does he think the impact of quantum computing is going to be? And he was gushing that any advances we're making now in most technology, cars, medicine, rocketry, aerospace, a lot of it is coming down to computers. So if we can just get to the point of having quantum computers, and that's a hand-wavy thing, as he'd say himself, sure, just get to that point, of 300 or 400 qubits, the advances that we would make with software then would be the equivalent of what we've made so far, he thinks, that we would be able to jump enormously. So I can imagine that he thinks it's maybe 10, 12 years off. But when we get to that point, software again will have this massive resurgence of what it can do for companies and technology.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. That'll be cool.
Yeah. Next thing that you wrote about in your article was how infrastructure changes are coming very quickly. And I'll just make one quick comment on that. I've been seeing that over the last number of years, that for myself, just sticking within the Microsoft world, it's impossible for me to keep up with just Microsoft. And I have a colleague who keeps up on Azure very much, and it's become impossible for him to keep up on just Azure.
Yeah, so, I mean, exactly. So from our point of view, basically, we can't even do a book on anything, for instance, because things move so fast that it wouldn't be correct even by the time we got it out. So that's why we're looking at different ways, you know, podcasts like you're doing and conference sessions and stuff like that. So the infrastructure changes, the reason I think that's really important is, you know, sort of looking at it from an architecture point of view, you used to have this monolith that you would patch and there'd be all this legacy code from, you know, 5 to 10 years or more. And you would just have to sort of deal with it. It was sort of a blockade, honestly, for what you would want to do. And so with the advent of microservices and continuous deployment, I think it makes it easier to implement basically what you want to do. I think it's a lot of, so it's also shifted a little bit, right? So it's no longer sort of like software developers like putting something together and then throwing it over the wall to, you know, operations engineers, right? It's so those two teams of sort of like, you know, operations engineers are now doing more software, and software is now thinking about, you know, obviously continuous deployment and stuff. So I think from a business point of view, it's a good thing, right? I think it makes it tough, as you mentioned, because things are continuously changing for software developers and systems engineers and operations folk. But I think it's a good thing because I think you don't have to deal with this like huge hulking sort of pile of legacy, hopefully, and you can add on and subtract things as needed. I'm sure other people sort of like down in the mess of things would disagree, because they would be like, it's the worst for all of the reasons you're saying it's the best. And I don't think microservices or something like that is the answer to everything, but I just think it makes, to use another buzzword, a company more agile.
One of the things I see with this is a lot of the, let's say, the big companies, the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Googles, they're putting out these frameworks or these technologies and techniques and then telling all of us that we should be doing something in a particular way. Mm-hmm. And you'll see companies kind of pivot and go, okay, well, someone said we should use Node and we're going to use Node. Or someone said we should use microservices, therefore we're going to use microservices. Right. And then what will happen is you'll have some well-known person writing about microservices come out and say, your microservices are crap unless... And you kind of... It becomes almost like a game where you're jumping from stone to stone and you can't land on the right thing, because the next person is saying, well, microservices are not really microservices unless you can have five of them go down and your system keeps operating. You just have a broken up monolith. Kind of without recognizing that the simple fact that you've got microservices means you've got a much more testable, smaller deployment units, easier to debug. But they're still telling you you're not good enough. And I've seen that happening repeatedly. And sometimes I wonder if a lot of the churn with regard to these things is really just companies looking for publicity and kind of saying, look, here's our cool framework and you should do it too. But that's coming from a company, let's say like Netflix, with almost unlimited resources. And they're telling a small company with five people. And you can't compare those. I was at a talk by a former CTO from Netflix, and he was saying that they were doing some test and they spun up X number of Amazon computers. It cost them $10,000 for the afternoon, but it was fantastic.
Right.
A lot of companies can't just spend $10,000 on a test.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that's helpful to learn from other companies. I mean, we were talking about that too. You know, we have different companies at our conferences, and it's great to sort of like see behind the curtain. I think the important thing, so I think it's great to have all of these choices. You're right. Like, a small company is not going to spend $10,000 in an afternoon. So I think that you need to, I think what's good is that there are choices, and that you need to understand what those choices are, and you need to understand what choices make sense for your company. I think that it's probably that, you know, monolith and doing things, you know, one way and putting it out in the world was probably not the best way to do everything for any size company. But yeah, I mean, I guess you have to take, like, if you see something from Netflix, I guess you have to take that and think, okay, we're not going to do that. But what I do like is that, you know, they did this, this, and this. So I think that's, and that's sort of what we want to present too. You know, of course we have certain content on a different, you know, different frameworks, like, or we have Node content, right? But I think what's most important and what I'm most proud of that we put out there is how to think about these things, how things actually work, how a microservice works and what it does for you, so that you can go out and decide, one, do I want that? Two, you know, what flavor do I want? Do I want to do a portion of that? How do I upkeep that? You know, how do you make a production ready microservice? So I think it's about taking in information from a lot of places, but then using sort of your own knowledge to make that work for you.
I can't remember which company it was, but it was one of the big tech ones. And I think they were saying that they're moving away from REST because mm-hmm. REST isn't good enough anymore. And it's just kind of, REST is fine.
Oh, so is that the Facebook stack?
I believe so. I can't remember what it's called. Yeah. Do you remember the name of it?
Is it GraphQL, that thing?
It could be. I can't remember. Yeah.
So I don't know. So that's always going to happen, right? So if something's like there and it's good enough, that's fine. And I'm sure there's lots of REST stuff out there and it's going to be used forever. But someone's always going to come along and be like, I don't know. That's not good for me. And then, you know, it kind of, I think, like something like GraphQL, it does seem like it's gaining steam if that's what we're referencing. And so, you know, there must be enough people out there, I think, that are don't think REST is good enough or are looking for something different, that will gain steam. Do you know what I mean? So I think it's that basically like a company will throw something out there, but it's if a community builds up around it that it will continue to thrive.
That's
so
true.
Yeah, so I don't know. So that's how I look at that one.
So I'm going to move on to the fifth topic that you wrote about in your article. And you think that this is going to be the year of artificial intelligence.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I know that this has been the year of AI like many times, like in the 90s. And then there's sort of like the AI winter, and it's sort of, AI sort of came back as different things like natural language processing and machine learning. But the pieces that I sort of see sticking are sort of stuff that we've touched on already. So the machine learning stuff, I think, is here to stay. And you're seeing that in different places. The sort of voice interaction, I think, is here to stay. I mean, I talk to my Apple Watch, which is fun, and it works, which I think is really important. So that natural language processing is there. The sort of being able to have, you know, somewhat, you know, chatbots have come into favor. Some of those are just sort of, you know, rewriting software, but some of those are actually, you know, do learn. So I think in little places we're seeing things start to stick. And so that's where I think we're going to see things stay. I don't know if it's necessarily like robots are coming to like take over the world, but like, There are components of AI which I think we're seeing in everyday technology that people are finding helpful and useful and are here to stay.
No, I agree. I years ago when I was at university, I developed a project to give access to books for people with reading difficulties, dyslexia, cerebral palsy, blind, various other things. And it was a massive amount of work. It involved many human readers recording books onto mini discs, editing them, turning them into real audio for streaming. Because back in that day, there wasn't the bandwidth for podcasts, I don't think existed, and there wasn't really the bandwidth for downloading large MP3s. Whereas now, you could just have Alexa read a book to you.
Right.
Or turn on the radio for you, or play some music for you.
Yeah, that's the thing too. I think figuring out what we want it to do, right? Like some things are creepy, some things are great. Like the idea, like with Alexa, you know, the thing, I don't actually have one yet. It seems awesome because like basically you're like, I have this question, who made the song or order me this book or whatever, right? But it's listening to you all the time. So I don't know. It's this sort of like adjustment. I don't know, you know, as new generations come along, are they going to assume that there's going to be something like that that does that for you? Whereas I'm like, yeah, that's creepy.
Yeah, I got one recently. It was a gift from a friend. And for me, it's primarily a radio station player because I can just tell it, change to this channel, change to that channel without having to go over to the computer or go over to the real radio, which I have. A friend of mine once walked into my house, looked at a thing on the in the kitchen and went, what's that? It's a radio. He hadn't seen one in years.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you weird. Know? No, and you know what I just got, too, was the Comcast Xfinity where you can talk into the remote and stuff. And so that's pretty fun that you don't have to like click through and stuff. Like I can say something like, I don't know, you know, like CNN and it'll go there or something. But what was really interesting was, you know, if you tell it today to, you know, turn off or something like that, it tells you like, I can't do that yet. I don't know. It's just fascinating how I've actually found that like at first I was like, who cares? I don't want to talk to my TV. That's stupid. But now I'm like, it's just easier to find things that way. So I think it's about finding ways in which that technology actually affects and enriches the customer's life.
But at the moment, all of these things feel, when you look at them, they're very limited. So I use Alexa yes. for a very set number of things and I can't use it for other things. I have an account with X.AI, the artificial intelligence scheduling system, where you have a artificial intelligence personal assistant, and it can do a lot of things. It can make appointments for me, it can cancel appointments, but it can't confirm appointments. But you know, it's a work in progress for them. They also plan to have it. I interviewed Dennis, the CEO of the company, some years ago, and they plan to have it as the interface to buying tickets. So if you've got an appointment in Florida, it'll buy your flights, it'll rent your car, it'll get your hotel. But again, it feels like we'll have lots of silos. Alexa will do certain things. Yeah. Amy will do certain things. Something else will do certain things. But there's nothing cohesive. It feels almost like we're calling it AI, but it's not really. It's just these language processing systems that can do a small number of things. But do you, when you say you think this is going to be the year of AI, do you think it's just going to be those things that are becoming popular, or do you see some bigger, let's say, all-encompassing AI coming relatively soon? I don't mean a dangerous one.
Yeah, no. Well, I think it's a couple of things. So I think it is, like you said, I think it is those siloed pieces. No, I don't think there's going to be some overarching AI yet. Although I wonder if the web can play a part in that. So that would be kind of interesting. I think, too, it's on the side of sort of like the deep learning and machine learning and the things that we don't necessarily think about, like how do you make search better? How can you take data and aggregate that better? And stuff that we wouldn't necessarily be like, that's AI. I think that is starting to impact us. But you're right. I think it is still sort of in some ways this sort of like toy thing in the consumer world. I don't know. I mean, like you take something, look at something like Google Glass was like, oh my God, like people like freaked out about it, right? And now it's sort of gone. But my guess is that, you know, maybe in like 10, 20 years, like that will somehow be like intricate to something that we do that we'll look back and be like, oh man, they had that 20 years ago.
Keeping in mind all the five topics we discussed, have you any advice for companies, developers and the like on how to keep the customer focused when they're considering open source, AI, infrastructure changes, etc.?
Well, yeah. So I think that's what it comes back to, right? So I think before you get to the technology, you have to think, you know, whoever your customer is, whether it's other companies, whether it's end users, you have to think, how are we serving those people? And if you have, and if you're like, take for instance, like something like Uber, like the people that they pick up are their customers, their Uber drivers are in some ways their customers. So you've got to think to yourself, you know, how do we provide whatever that person wants? Or how do we facilitate whatever that person wants? So I think you have to start there and really understand that and talk to customers and do testing and stuff like that. And then what's great, I think, is that we're at a point where basically most of what you can think of in that way, you can make happen with technology, which is, I think, what's cool. But I think that's a way to guide what to do with technology as well. So like Netflix, for instance, right? They just want to make sure that, you know, it's never down. They want to make sure that, you know, when you click Stranger Things, you know, it comes up. You know, there are reasons why they do the things that they do. And they're very successful. Like, I can't remember the last time that Netflix didn't work for me. But like, if it didn't work, I would be like, man, Netflix is down. You know, so I just think that's a good, really solid place to start your sort of thinking and decision making for how to move forward. And then that's when you start to think, okay, what's out there? How can I do this? Like, what do we really need to do? And then you start to be like, okay, well, here are our options for tools and techniques. So if you're having an issue sort of trying to figure out where to go next, I think that's a good place to start.
Any final notes before we wrap up this morning, Rachel?
I guess I would just say I'd love to anyone here. I'd love to see you at our conferences, OzCon and Fluent. And
just remind us of the dates again. So.
Sure. So OzCon is May 8th, it starts. Fluent is June 20th. And come, and the other thing I didn't mention was safaribooksonline.com. Is basically where you can find all of our stuff that hopefully would be very helpful to you. And if you don't have a membership already, there's a free trial there. And I hope we can be of some help to you.
Well, Rachel Romeliotis, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Dvorak's Serenade for Strings, Opus 22 in E major, Larghetto, performed by the Advent Chamber Orchestra.